Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. Thank you for joining us today. I hope everyone's having a great new year. I hope it's treating you very well. And those of you who are practicing dry January, I hope it's doing something good. I hope you are. Your skin looks better. You're getting better sleep, or you know whatever it is it's supposed to do. I hope it's doing well for you. I am doing a damp January. I'm joined today by Claire Copey, who is also doing a... You doing dry January, Claire?
I'm doing dry. I went damp last year, but I'm going full dry this year.
Okay. All right.
Yep.
Well, good. More power to you. Look, we'll continue to check in on your progress and make sure you're doing okay.
Yeah. There,
you know?
Thanks.
Well, I just want to say, today's podcast, we have a real one for you here, folks. We are going to discuss wine scandals, some real wild, mostly in winemaking, but some real wild scandals that have hit the wine industry over the last, say, well, one of them's quite old, but the last mostly, say, 40, 50 years that have really changed a lot of the laws in wine and changed the way wine's allowed to be made. And so before we do that, I want to say today's podcast is brought to you by Napa Valley Vintners. Did you know on SOM TV right now, on all apps, on any device, you can watch a roundup with some of the greatest winemakers from Napa discuss the 2023 vintage, which is shaping up to be one of the greatest vintages in the history of Napa, which is astounding. This really long, long growing season. It was really cool. They picked late. I mean, they were picking, in some cases, into early November. It was crazy. And so what it did is it allowed the wine to age and age and age on the vine and really gave this incredible structured wine. So we sat down up in Napa with a bunch of winemakers and they went through it. And you can watch that for free right now on SOM TV on any device, on our app, or on the web. So, Claire, let's talk wine scandals. You and I have been talking for a little bit about a high-level pod about some of the more, scandalous things that have happened in the wine industry. And
yes.
I have a couple. You have a couple.
Yeah.
And these are not, they're not just entertaining. As I said in the open, they are the bedrock of kind of some of the laws of why wine has to be made the way it has to be made, especially in the European Union. Some of these scandals are Americans might look at and go, this is a scandal. Others are incredible, dangerous even, you know, people could die from them. So why don't I start with one that I'm not sure if listeners are familiar with. This is crazy. I heard about this probably 10 or 12 years ago when I first started really getting serious about the history of wine. And this happened in 1985. This is called the Austrian diethylene glycol wine scandal. Real sexy name, just rolls right off the top. Yeah, just rolls right off the top.
Wow, that's juicy.
Yeah, so this is a scandal. If anybody's had, Austrian wine has come a very long way in the last 30, 40, 50 years. Now it is among some of the great wines of the world. But there was a point where if you mentioned Austrian wine, a lot of that was bulk wine. Not all of it, and I'm not trying to demean the whole country, but a lot of it was bulk wine. And a lot of it went into Germany. So they would take all of the wine, they would put it in large containers, white or red, mostly white, bring it to West Germany, because at that point, you know, it was still Soviets on East Germany. So they bring it to West Germany, and then what they would do is bottle it there. And so there was this laboratory in 1985 that was bottling a bunch of wine, white wines that were supposed to be sweet, kind of late harvest wines. And they just ran a routine test and they found a chemical called diethylene glycol in that. And does that chemical mean anything to you?
It does not. Gly suggests sugar
of
some glycol, kind to me?
Not the kind of sugar you would like to have in your wine. So this is one of the components in a lot of antifreeze.
Oh,
and
shit.
So they found antifreeze effectively, or one of the components of antifreeze in white wines that, you know, these are wines that are sold mostly before they're even harvested. This is giant bulk grocery store wine. And so this was going to the consumers and who knows how long had been going to the consumers. So this this laboratory in West Germany, they alert the Austrians that they had found this. And there was this kind of bit of a cover-up that started to happen. And it's not every producer. I want to be very clear. This was only a small number of producers. They were able to trace this to a small number of producers. And so this giant scandal erupts. And the Germans and the Europeans, there was no European Union then, but the Europeans really wanted to understand why and how did this get in. And the answer is quite simple. They weren't able to ripen these wines as far as they wanted. And they didn't have a fungus called noble rot that that often attacks the grapes and makes them sweeter. And they didn't have this particular year or several years in a row. And so a proprietor at one winery and several other wineries working together started adding diethylene glycol.
That's
to
crazy.
Their wines. Yeah.
And I mean, is that like cheaper? Is it super cheap to use?
Super cheap.
This super okay, cheap. So that's why. Because there are other ways to chapelize your wine if you legally can in certain areas. But this is crazy.
Super cheap.
So it's like cutting like a drug with meth because it's cheap.
Yeah, it'd be like cutting a drug with something. Yeah, I mean, I don't know about meth, but like, you know, I'm not sure what the equivalent would be in cutting, but cutting it for sure with like something dirt cheap to make it seem like you're getting real cocaine in your analogy, and you're really just getting a bunch of talc powder or something. Yeah. I mean, it's really, really dangerous to drink this stuff. So what it does is this stuff builds up in your liver and your kidneys very quickly, and it people die from it all the time. In fact, this is a chemical that kills thousands and thousands of pets, poisons tons of humans in the United States every single year. It's like one of the big poison control centers. And they've started adding to antifreeze. They started adding like bitter agents because this stuff tastes very sweet. You can understand why they would have done this, but it's also like kind of the plot from Fargo. Like these guys are like doing something where you know for a fact you're going to eventually get caught doing this.
Yeah.
I mean, I would assume there's a lot of money to be made in selling hundreds of thousands of liters of wine. You're probably making good money, but
sure, but there's like no longevity in that, right? And then eventually you're just going to completely damage the entire brand of Austrian wines. And
this took Austria decades to climb out of. And the real sad part about it is not that, well, obviously the danger to humans is the real sad part. And I should state, it was all over the map how much of this chemical was in. There were some bottles where it was like, you know, 4 grams would be inside like a few liters. You know, there'd be a few grams in a liter, and that would take, you'd have to drink 4 bottles of this wine for you to get to a level where it's dangerous. But others were 40 grams in one bottle, which is like one bottle, you could have like kidney failure and die.
Did anyone get hurt?
So some people did get sick, and I don't know of anyone who actually died. And I think that they caught this in the very early stages of it. I don't know that a lot of this went out to the public. It's tough because it looks like there's a lot of give and takes in the legal ramifications of sort of how it went back and forth with these producers. But the big thing was, are they going to name who put the diethylene glycol in the wines? And through a bunch of court cases, they did win and they named these producers. And then, of course, the prison sentence starts coming out because this isn't just you're duping the consumer. This is consumers could die. So we're going to get to a scandal after this where you're duping a consumer. In this case, this is a you could die. And so, or at least be, you know, at least have some kind of liver damage or something just from, you know, look, you're drinking a 4 euro bottle of wine. You're just expecting to get off work and have a glass of wine. You're not expecting to have like, you know, permanent damage from it. So what this ended up doing was damaging the Austrian wine industry for a very long time. And I think they've done a good job of trying to make people realize that Austrian wine is good. It also helps a lot that high acid wines have come into fashion. And so you don't have to play these shenanigans and everything doesn't have to be sweet to be enjoyable. And so Austria produces some of the greatest high acid wines in the world. But one of these houses was, you know, found to have done this. I'm gonna mess this up, but it's Firma Gebruder Grill. And so the proprietor, his name was Karl Grill. He was sentenced to 1.5 years in jail in Austria. Wow. And when that happened, he killed himself. And if you can imagine, you know, you're a multi-generational Austrian firm that probably makes more than just wine. You probably make many things. This is your identity. And so being caught in a scandal like this is pretty bad. So this was 1985, and hopefully, you know, you can understand why people are so scared about what is added to your wine. And in most cases, those arguments are complete bullshit. I mean, they really are. It's like, I'm terrified of X, Y, and Z being in my wine. But in some cases, they're not wrong.
Yeah, I mean, then you have idiots like this that give them a lot of clout. That's scary. I had never heard about that. So Austrian wines did a good job of pivoting. But like, shit, that's scary. Didn't, really quick side tangent, didn't Fireball also get caught putting something like, because I remember there being something like, oh, they're putting antifreeze in Fireball now. Not that I'm a Fireball aficionado, but I think
I'm unaware. I mean, I remember when I met you, you were sitting on a curb. You were drinking Fireball.
As I do.
Yeah. It was an AC/DC concert, I think, outside. And I'll never forget.
That sounds awesome,
you,
actually. No, that sounds great.
I'm unaware of this, but if I was to pick something that probably did this, it would be Fireball. Sorry to Fireball.
Yeah. That or Jaeger or something. Sorry.
And I also did some weird, my Google history is going to be really messed up because I was trying to find what exactly does antifreeze taste like? You know, meaning like, what's the taste profile? I went down this rabbit hole of going, all right, is there a fruit profile at least, or is it just sweet? And you know what I found? This is
some
not
stupid
shock
kid
you.
On YouTube that's like, no, chugging it.
I found during World War II, Russian tank operators used tons of antifreeze because they fought the war half of the time in the snow and the ice, and their tanks would freeze up. And so they used antifreeze not just in the engines, they used it in like the hydraulic presses, they used it in everything, and they had drums of it. And they used to taste it not because it was delicious, but because new antifreeze is sweeter than antifreeze that has been as aged. And so when I was looking for taste profiles, I came down this whole wormhole that the level of sweetness has a lot to do with how fresh it is. And so the Russians would taste it just to know, okay, this is the really good antifreeze. This should go in the engine. This antifreeze is a little older. We're going to put it in the pneumatic press.
It's just like, those people are made of iron, I swear to God.
I'm like reading this article and I'm like, well, no shit, the Germans couldn't beat them. I mean, this is like, yeah, these guys are drinking antifreeze for their tanks.
Jesus.
Whatever. So back to Austrian wines, which I love. And, you know, I'm not trying to. Yeah. Anywho, don't drink antifreeze. Okay.
Don't drink antifreeze, people. And geez, that's why there are great laws in place to test these wines to make sure you're not drinking. Woof.
There was a huge law put in place it was like a purity act in Austria. And they had a problem in that harvest was happening at the time of this scandal. And so they rushed this law through. So there you go.
Yeah.
And I'm sure those laws followed into the European Union. I can guarantee you that there's a lot of lab work done on wines now because of this. What do you got?
Let's move on to another scandal, shall we? This was one that I didn't really know much about. I had heard whispers of, and it was really cool to research. It kind of like reads like a, I don't know. I think this would make a great movie if it had gone on longer, but it didn't, thankfully, because it involves arguably the greatest wine and greatest vineyard, certainly the most expensive of all time. And this happened in early January of 2010. So it's snowy, it's winter. Imagine at nighttime, the vines are all quiet. And in the vineyards of La Romanée Conti, somebody starts creeping through the vines and takes a drill to two vines and injects something into these vines. And then shortly after that, the proprietor, owner, winemaker, gentleman who you have met, Aubert de Villene,
yes,
receives a mysterious letter with complete drawings of his vineyards, like very detailed drawings of his vineyards, and a threat that if he doesn't comply to a request that is forthcoming, he's going to lose a lot of these vineyards. And so in the second parcel, he receives another drawing with a circle on it that says, if you do not put 1 million euros in this spot at this time, we are going to poison and wipe out a huge chunk of your vineyards. And by the way, two vines are poisoned right here, and then 80 more are poisoned right here. And so they obviously immediately go out to the vineyards. They take out those two vines and test them. And indeed, they are poisoned and dying. And then they check on the other 80 vines. That was a bluff. So fortunately, those vines are safe. They're like, shit, what do we do? I mean, I haven't been to Burgundy. You've been to Burgundy many times, right?
Oh, yeah. You've never been to Burgundy, Claire?
I've never been to Burgundy. I know. It's sad. Someone send me to Burgundy, please.
I think we will
That's
have
another
to arrange
scandal.
That. No.
They're very competitive with their neighbors. They're very secretive, I think, about what they do there. It's a very small rural area. And Aubert de Villene didn't want to go to the local authorities because he knew that, you know, by the next morning, everybody would know about this and think that his vineyards were going to be wiped out and the story would go, you know, widespread in the wine community. And so he went to someone that he knew that worked in Paris. And they come out and they're like, okay, here's what we're going to do. Respond to this person and tell them, you know, you'll get the money by this day. You just have to rearrange.
So is this
funds.
Like a private investigator? They're like they're hiring their own. Sounds like you ever seen the movie Ransom with Mel Gibson?
I haven't, like, Jason.
This is the exact same plot.
Is it?
No,
is he
it's
a wine?
Not.
Is he the
no,
most
no.
famous winemaker in the world?
It's not. I'm sorry. I was hoping you would know it. Then I could quote that film. No,
Jason's
I
always
think
dropping movies I need to watch.
I just want to talk about movies. That's all I want to do.
He's pivoting.
So wait, so the person they went to, is this like somebody who is an action taker or a negotiator? I mean, because I think this is
an action taker, I believe.
This is insane.
He called a police official that he'd met in Dijon that was now a senior official with police based in Paris. So he's, you know, it's not a private investigator. It's somebody who works with police in Paris. They decide that they're going to not drop off the money right away, but they're going to have he's not going to drop it off himself, but they're going to have like an employee drop it off, someone similar, because it's at nighttime. They're like, this will be easy. The person can easily confuse it for Aubert de Villene. And Aubert had to be like somewhere else for, you know, work basically. So in the dead of night, they put the package out there and they end up catching the guy. Like this guy, I mean, it's kind of stupid how quickly and easily they tie it up. You know, like he just kind of like meanders out of the forest. But this guy knew what he was doing. So this gentleman's name is Jacques Salty. And he had built a little cottage in the forest near the vineyards. And he had like shacked up there to wait. He had a bunch of Roundup, which is what he was injecting into the vines to kill them. And he had grown up in Epernay, up in Champagne. And his parents were very small winemakers. So he knew exactly what he was doing. But I find it ridiculous then that he's like, oh, okay, thank you, drop it off at this time. And he just wanders out there and gets it. Like, yeah, you're going to be arrested, dude.
It's not every like, one of these things, every one of these things is just Jerry Lundegaard from Fargo. I mean, like, Fargo season Fargo six reference. Needs to just be this French guy in the woods drilling into vines.
It's brilliant, though. Like, he should have, like, figured, I just can't believe he whiffed that hard on it. Like, shit.
I've spent a fair amount of time in Von Romane at this precise, in these vineyards. And mm-hmm. They're not hard. You can walk into them, which is crazy because what do they say?
Not like supposed to.
Well, but you can. Meaning like, of course you're not supposed to. I'm just saying. I mean,
but you can.
Every grape is worth $20 or $10. I mean, probably. This wine goes for, you know, depends on which plot, which everything. I mean, a lot of people listening know a lot about DRC, but, you know, these wines can go for $12,000 on release. These wines can go for $2,000 on release. But those plants themselves are, you know, mythical huge. Beasts as far as money goes, what they produce, the amount of money that they make, each one of those amazing vines from a cash standpoint. Jesus Jones, what did they do to this guy? How did they punish him?
This guy did have a record. So, you know, he spent a lot of his time behind bars and he got a little help from his son with this as well, who had followed Villene and learned where he lived and stuff like that to get the address for the letter. So they're both put in prison. Not much came of it, though, because Jacques ended up hanging himself in prison. So we have another lovely scandalous story that ends up with somebody killing themselves in prison. Yeah. So they couldn't go forward with much. And he had also threatened to do it as well to another winemaker, another very prestigious estate in Burgundy, the Vogue.
Comte de Vogue. Yeah.
Didn't go through with that. But yeah, there was a lot of groundwork laid to do this. So that's why I'm kind of like, I'm happy it didn't work out, but I'm a little annoyed at Jacques for not planning his getaway a little bit better.
My biggest nitpick with this would be like, don't show him where to put the, you're going to have to do a better money exchange. I mean, this is a great place to talk about movies because this guy, the French have made some great movies. You know, Jean-Pierre Melville has directed some great movies about people who have stolen money from others and had to exchange it. So like, if he had just watched some films about how to do this, you know, he probably could have been better. You're going to get busted.
Could have learned a little bit better.
If you're telling them where to put the money, they know you're going to have to go pick it up.
It led to, I mean, you know, they wanted to keep this very quiet, basically. All the winemakers in Burgundy, they don't really kind of want to admit to how vulnerable they can be and what a target they're, you know. But these are some of the biggest money makers in the world. So
yeah,
I'm not surprised.
Amazing.
Anyway, what else you got?
I got one, you know, this one is fascinating to me because it just gets into the insane laws and rules that Europe has. And I know you have one really quick, so we'll kind of loop these together and talk about them. But this one is called Brunellopoly, which is, I love when people come up with these dumb names, you know, just rolls off the tongue. Another place that I've spent a fair amount of time is Montalcino, which is in Tuscany. And there they have a very famous clone of Sangiovese. And they make Brunello di Montalcino, and it's a very revered wine. It often tannic, requires a lot of aging, can be incredibly expensive. You know, this wine was started by Biondi Santi, who had the first clone, 1800s, you know, yada, yada, yada. So it's a very important, lot of rules. What has to be 100% Sangiovese. And not just that, the clone that makes Brunello Montalcino. So in 2008, there is a guy. There's always a guy, right? This is the guy. It's this guy writing for this paper, Wine Spectator. And his name is James Suckling.
You heard of him?
And he is one of two reporters. He's one of the first guys that starts reporting that there is an allegation in Montalcino that a lot of wines from different producers are being made with grapes that are not Sangiovese and not the clone of Sangiovese to increase profit. So James Suckling starts writing about the difference in color, the difference in tannin structure, all these things. And if there's one thing, James Suckling knows how to taste wine, and he's tasted a lot of wine, and he knows a lot about Italian wine, as much as someone can know about Italian wine from a fact standpoint. And, you know, he starts writing that this is like normally an expensive product. The wine doesn't taste that expensive. It tastes too approachable. You and I have both had a lot of Montalcino, Brunello Montalcino. Mm. It is a big wine, often, not always, but often a very big wine, and it requires a lot of aging. And so they get into this whole thing and they start, well, they have to do some reverse engineering. They have to do some testing. And like most scandals where people are doing it only for money, somebody's going to turn.
Mm.
So through a series of testing and reverse engineering, they have this situation where they have 20 firms, 20 wineries in the area that come under investigation, I guess. And they find out that a lot of these grapes, they're not even Tuscan grapes. They're bringing grapes from, you know, the south of Italy. So very fruit forward, much warmer regions, you know, Sicilian grapes, Sicilian red grapes. And it was almost like, geez, you know, you probably could have just gotten like some riper Chianti or something.
I was going to say, you can basically just make Chianti then. And like, you're right there.
You're not allowed to call it Chianti. It would have had to be declassified. Right. I mean, if they found out, you're going from wine that's like $60 to $300 a bottle.
But I'm saying if you're going to do something fraudulent, like at least, you know, make it a little easier on yourself.
The biggest thing was they figured out there's no health risk to the consumer. So like they made that out. And of course, why did they do this? They had made this announcement because of the scandal we talked about earlier, the antifreeze scandal. So they put that out, but then everybody wanted to know what wineries are screwing us. Mm. And they forced all 20 of these firms, they forced them all to admit. And huge producers that came out, like Castello Banfi, Argiana, you know, just a huge amount of really important winemakers that ended up in this list that had to admit they were being investigated. They didn't have to admit that they were the ones that did it, but they had to admit they were being investigated. And I think what happened, honestly, over time is it just became pretty lax and the money was rolling in. And this was a time with, you know, Parker and all this stuff where big fruity wines were really important. And that's not often what Brunello is. Brunello is often a very stern tannic wine that requires aging. And so it's just different than what people wanted at the moment that was getting a lot of buzz. And so you can understand why they were putting these big fleshy ripe grapes in their wine to make it drinkable now.
Well, you look at like the birth of Super Tuscan.
Yeah, exactly. No, this is right at the same time. I mean, Super Tuscans are exploding. Sesicaia, all of those, Tignanello, all of those are exploding because everybody liked these big wines that were drinkable now. You know, I mean, it was a huge, huge, huge thing. So the critics went nuts. It was just this big mess of a mess. So the Consorzio di Brunello di Montalcino, they didn't do what you expected. They cleaned it up from the inside out, but they also sued newspapers who were like,
seriously?
It was a whole
how
mess.
How dare
you
report the news?
Yeah. And, but they mostly were suing newspapers that were saying there could be a health risk because that's where the juicy story was this is, it really was, there was no health risk. So in the end, this was just you're asking for a Ferrari and you're getting a Ferrari body and it might have, you know, a bit of a, you know, a Ford engine in it, you know?
Yeah.
It was a little bit of a dupe. You were getting
Do you think
duped.
They caught it all? I wonder.
Hell no.
I wonder if there's still some, you know?
I don't think it's a hot take to say this is definitely still going on. Not in Brunello, but in other regions for sure.
It. But I mean, as far as the 08 Brunello vintage, then I wonder if like people are more, I don't feel like there's any price difference as far as like 08 goes. Like, I don't think it really affected the resale value of the 08 that I know of. But
yeah.
I wonder if 08 is less prized than, you know, like great vintages, like obviously 2010, where there wasn't any proven fraud.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, Eric Asimov, who writes for the New York Times, he wrote, I mean, when people were like freaking out about this, he was like, why are you guys freaking out? There's been rumors for 25 years that grapes in major regions were using different, you know, the wrong grapes. I mean, for him, it was just like, this is not news. It's just not.
It happens all over the place.
Yeah. And this is a similar scandal. I mean, there wasn't a ton of change other than the rules were tightened. They put the thumb screws down. They said, them's the rules. You have to have 100% Sangiovese from now on. No messing around, even though that was the rule. Now we're going to be on your ass about it because they want to keep the prices up and they want to keep consumer trust up. And you have a very similar one. So this was, I assume you're going to go with the Chateau de Pop story.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, it's a very similar kind of thing. And I mean, this is kind of the motherland of wine law and, you know, premium winemaking. And it's kind of funny that it's happening at Chateauneuf-du-Pape, which is one of the original, you know, appellations that was officially created. Chateauneuf-du-Pape is one of the most, you know, premium French wines that you can get. This wasn't coming from, you know, super premium winemakers, but it was coming from a bulk wine merchant. And so this wine merchant was buying, you know, wine from hundreds of different producers to blend and bottle the wine. Basically, what he was doing is he was taking millions of liters of, you know, cheaper, more simple Côte de Rhône, which is a blend of grapes from all over the region, not just specifically, you know, from Chateauneuf-du-Pape. And he just labeled it and sold it as Chateauneuf-du-Pape over a period of 4 years. And that's quite a while, I feel, for Côte de Rhône. Côte de Rhône's great on its own. But I mean, if we're comparing it to what Chateauneuf-du-Pape is, again, Chateauneuf-du-Pape, like Brunello, it needs a little bit of time. It's a meaty, you know, dense wine that needs a little time to chill out. And Côte de Rhône is much more approachable and much more fruit-driven and, you know, light and lifted and all of that. So I was kind of surprised that it went on for that long.
This is very similar to the Brunello. I mean, Chateauneuf-du-Pape, it's the opposite end of the spectrum where you have many grapes that are allowed in Chateauneuf-du-Pape, whereas one grape's allowed in Brunello Montalcino, but it's one of these very vaulted, history-driven, often very expensive, you know, wines that demands collecting and storage versus drinking it quickly. I happen to love Côte de Rhône. There's also a small village of Côte de Rhône that's an actual appellation that, you know, is often not talked about because it wasn't protected. So you can get real Côte de Rhône, which is this little tiny place, and you can get Côte de Rhône, which just means this huge area. But those wines are fantastic, but they are ready to drink. Yeah, so if you really know your shit, you're going to know immediately that this is not Chateauneuf-du-Pape.
Yeah. it's not like, I mean, we can reference, you know, another scandal that I think has been talked a lot about, which is, you know, Rudy, who did a much better job at creating fraudulent wines because he had an amazing palate and blended some really great wines together to make it seem like an even greater wine. You know, there's not a huge disparity between his wines and his fakes as there is between, I think, Côte de Rhône and Chateauneuf-du-Pape.
Yeah, well, when you're blending great wines, it's pretty easy. I mean, if you're making, to use the sports car analogy again, it's like if you're building a sports car out of other good sports cars, you're probably going to have a fast car. And those, you know, Rudy was not, it wasn't Two Buck Chuck he was faking it with. It was very good wine. Well, Claire, this is why I'm always like on my pulpit that there's wines that are inexpensive, that are worth the money and delicious. Because whenever you buy wines that are at a price point that's higher, you know, you're playing a certain game. It's more than wine. Mm. It's collectible. It's this, it's that. And this kind of stuff falls in. But it goes to show the scandals are not just at the top end. It's at the bottom end, too, when it comes to bulk wine ending up with poison in it, essentially. I'd love to know from listeners, what other scandals would you guys like us to talk about? I know there are many, many, many. Obviously, we've covered the court. You know, there's the Jefferson bottles. If you want to learn about those, you can turn into the President's Day podcast that I did in February. There's just, you know, I love this stuff and want to keep talking about it. So message us on Instagram or anywhere else and let us know what you think. And if you love this podcast, please give us a great rating. Anywhere you listen to it, give us a good rating, and that would be really appreciated. And don't forget, go to SomTV.com. You can watch great, great stuff, including the Napa Valley Vintners. Discuss the 2023 vintage, which is shaping up to be one of the best vintages in recent memory. So go to SomTV.com and sign up. And download our apps. You can watch that episode and many other things for free right now, or sign up to watch over 500 hours of original content. I want to thank everybody, and hopefully you have a great, great new year and spend a lot of it with us here at SomTV. We'll talk soon.